Bush Derangement Syndrome. Diane Rehm, why do you think he, Bush, is suppressing that September 11 report? Howard Dean, I don't know. There are many theories about it. The most interesting theory that I've heard so far, which is nothing more than a theory, it can't be proved, is that he was warned ahead of time by the Saudis. Now, who knows what the real situation is? The Diane Rehm Show, NPR, December 1st, 2003. It's been 25 years since I discovered a psychiatric syndrome. For the record, Secondary Mania, Archives of General Psychiatry, November 1978. And in the interim, I haven't been looking for new ones. But it's time to don the white coat again. A plague is abroad in the land. Bush Derangement Syndrome. The acute onset of paranoia in otherwise normal people in reaction to the policies, the presidency, nay, the very existence of George W. Bush. Now, I cannot testify to Howard Dean's sanity before this campaign, but five terms as governor by a man with no visible tics and no history of involuntary confinement is pretty good evidence of a normal mental status. When he avers, however, that the most interesting theory as to why the president is suppressing the September 11 report is that Bush knew about September 11 in advance, it's time to check on Thorazine supplies. When Representative Cynthia McKinney, Democrat of Georgia, first broached this idea before the 2002 primary election, it was considered so nutty it helped make her former Representative McKinney. Today, the Democratic presidential front-runner professes agnosticism as to whether the President of the United States was tipped off about 9/11 by the Saudis, and it goes unnoticed. The virus is spreading. It is, of course, epidemic in New York's Upper West Side and the tonier parts of Los Angeles, where the very sight of the president, say, smiling while holding a tray of Thanksgiving turkey in a Baghdad mess hall, caused dozens of cases of apoplexy in otherwise healthy adults. What is worrying epidemiologists about the Dean incident, however, is that heretofore no case had been reported in Vermont or any other dairy state. Moreover, Dean is very smart. Until now, Bush Derangement Syndrome, BDS, had generally struck people with previously compromised intellectual immune systems. Hence its prevalence in Hollywood. Barbara Streisand, for example, wrote her famous September 2002 memo to Dick Gephardt, warning that the president was dragging us toward a war to satisfy among the usual corporate malefactors who clearly have much to gain if we go to war against Iraq, the logging industry, timber being a major industry in a country that is two-thirds desert. It is true that BDS has struck some pretty smart guys. Bill Moyers ranting about a right-wing wrecking crew engaged in a deliberate, intentional destruction of the United States way of governing, and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, whose recent book attacks the president so virulently that Krugman's British publisher saw fit to adorn the cover with images of Vice President Cheney in a Hitler-like mustache and Bush stitched up like Frankenstein. Nonetheless, some observers took that to be satire. Others wrote off Moyers and Krugman as simple aberrations, the victims of too many years of neurologically hazardous punditry. That's what has researchers so alarmed about Dean. He had none of the usual risk factors. Dean has never opined for a living and has no detectable sense of humor. Even worse is the fact that he is now exhibiting symptoms of a related illness, Murdoch Derangement Syndrome, MDS, in which otherwise normal people believe that their minds are being controlled by a single, very clever Australian. Chris Matthews, would you break up Fox? Howard Dean, on ideological grounds, absolutely yes. But I don't want to answer whether I would break up Fox or not. What I'm going to do is appoint people to the FCC that believe democracy depends on getting information from all portions of the political spectrum, not just one. Some clinicians consider this delusion, that Americans can get their news from only one part of the political spectrum, the gravest of all. They report that no matter how many times sufferers in padded cells are presented with flashcards with the symbols ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, NPR, PBS, Time, Newsweek, New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, they remain unresponsive, some in a terrifying near-catatonic torpor. The sad news is that there is no cure, but there is hope. There are many fine researchers seeking that cure. Your donation to the BDS Foundation, no matter how small, can help. Mailing address, Republican National Committee, Washington, D.C., Attention Psychiatric Department. Just make sure your amount does not exceed $2,000, $4,000 for a married couple. The Washington Post, December 5th, 2003. Life by Manual. My channel surfing was arrested by the news reporter at the Manhattan courthouse, recounting the day's doings at the Woody Allen-Mia Farrow custody fight. Testimony today, she said, focused on Woody Allen's lack of parenting skills. By this she meant that on the witness stand, Allen had admitted that he, one, could not name a single one of his children's friends, two, had never taken the children to the barber or given them a bath, three, did not know who their dentist was, four, had never attended a parent-teacher conference for son Satchel. In fact, the three children whose custody he seeks had never spent a night at his apartment. Lack of parenting skills? One might as well say that Jeffrey Dahmer lacked interpersonal skills, or that Robespierre could have used some sensitivity training. The problem here is not some absence of technique. It is the absence of something far more basic, an instinct, a feeling, the normal bond that ties the average parent to his child. Allen's problem is self-absorption taken, as with most everything in his life, to the point of parody. Here is the artiste, so jealous of his autonomy, so disdainful of attachment, that his children may not spend the night at his apartment, though this should not prevent the court from awarding him custody. Of course, given the alternative, the hysterical Ms. Farrow, whose narcissism expresses itself not in detachment, but in a self-indulgence that acquires children like stray pets, Allen may turn out to be the better choice. The sight of these two vying for custody of that pathetic brood makes you wonder how a society that requires licenses for drivers manages without requiring them for parents. The reason is that nature endows most people, in all cultures, with an instinctive parental feeling that translates into often clumsy, sometimes wrong-headed, but generally benign and benevolent care. The fact that the grotesque absence of these qualities in Allen could be interpreted as a lack of parenting skills shows how far we've gone in the belief in the mechanization of ordinary human feeling. Sexual intimacy, for example. A skill like any other, concludes Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Richard Rhodes in his recent sexual autobiography. There are entire bookshelves of wildly successful manuals, How to Satisfy a Woman Every Time, 55 weeks on the bestseller list, to show how far from alone Rhodes is in this belief. Self-improvement through the acquisition of skill is, of course, hardly a new American theme. First mass-marketed by Dale Carnegie, it owes its popularity to the marriage of two powerful American beliefs, human perfectibility and the power of technology. In the past, however, tradition and community acted as partial antidotes to this tendency. But with the modern decline of tradition and community as guides to experience, the mechanization of behavior is complete. Every human activity is now the subject of the how-to industry. A visit to the local bookstore shows how far things have gone. Not just parenting and loving, but everything. Eating and drinking, running and sunning, living itself is a skill to be learned and mastered. There are books, videos, multi-billion-dollar industries for teaching people such exotic skills as losing weight, try eating less, and exercise, try running around. The business succeeds because Americans have come to believe that only an expert can teach them the correct way to, say, walk, or bend their knees, or think well of themselves. The idea that everything is a skill to be learned, like a golf swing, applies far beyond the field of family and sexual intimacy. We now have training for the proper love of strangers. Marge Schott, owner of the Cincinnati Reds, and given to racist remarks, is sentenced by baseball owners to sensitivity training. This will make her nice. 5 years ago, a religious student at the University of Michigan expressed the view that homosexuality is immoral. He was made to recant and ordered a dose of sensitivity training. This will make him broad-minded. This project for the inculcation of proper human feelings through behavioral technique is either sinister or idiotic. It is sinister when it works, as in communist China, where they have learned how to break one's character through extremes of coercion, deprivation, and torture. These means are not yet available to American educators and family therapists, which explains their low success rate. Some things, alas, cannot be taught. Woody Allen, the movie character, once said, "I've had 17 years of psychotherapy, one more and I'm going to Lourdes." Time's up, Woody. You've tried technique. Now get on that plane. The Washington Post, April 2nd, 1993. From People Power to Polenta. When Catherine Ann Power, 60s radical bank robber fugitive, turned herself in last week after 23 years on the run, she added another entry to her already crowded resume, Unwitting Historian. Her brief explanatory statement released upon her surrender to Boston police is a document historians of the future puzzling over what happened to the 60s will find useful. They will ignore the usual mitigating phrases about actions she now characterizes as naive and unthinking. One does not ordinarily think of a bank robbery in which a policeman father of nine is shot in the back as an act of naivete. "My intention was never to damage any human life," she says. It apparently never occurred to her that when robbing a bank in the company of three ex-cons, a shotgun and a submachine gun, somebody might get hurt. Nor is there anything unusual about her spirit of the age defense, wherein she insists that her deeds should be seen in the context of a time when many others, she cites, for example, Daniel Ellsberg, leaker of the Pentagon Papers, were breaking the law. There's a certain moral gap between unauthorized leaking and armed robbery that this defense does not bridge. No matter, these run-of-the-mill self-justifications are window dressing. What everyone wants to know is not why Catherine Power robbed a bank in 1970. We know she wanted to save the world, but why she finally gave it up in 1993. It is her account of the return that yields the one truly memorable line in this text, the one historians will ponder to their benefit. "I know that I must answer this accusation from the past in order to live with full authenticity in the present." So Catherine Power came in from the cold in search of full authenticity. Not out of remorse or resignation, not seeking forgiveness or repentance. She did not return out of guilt, explained her husband. She just tired of telling lies, of living as Alice Metzinger, wife, cook, restaurateur, but with a shrouded past and troubled future. She wanted her life back, said her husband. She wanted her truth back. She wants to be whole. That Officer Schroeder will not get his life back troubled her. His death was shocking to me, but that is not why she surrendered. Or she would have done so 23 years ago. In fact, as elaborated in the front page New York Times story about her psychotherapy for depression, her surrender, for the sake of full authenticity, was a form of therapy, indeed the final therapeutic step toward regaining her sense of self. Alan Bloom once described a man who had just gotten out of prison, where he'd undergone therapy. He said he had found his identity and learned to like himself, writes Bloom. A generation earlier, he would have found God and learned to despise himself as a sinner. In an age where the word sin has become quaint, reserved for such offenses against hygiene as smoking and drinking, which alone merit sin taxes, surrendering to the authorities for armed robbery and manslaughter is not an act of repentance, but of personal growth, explains Jane Alpert, another 60s radical who served time for her part in a series of bombings that injured 21 people. Ultimately, I spent many years in therapy learning to understand, to tolerate, and forgive both others and myself. Learning to forgive oneself. Very important nowadays for revolutionaries with a criminal bent. What a pathetic trajectory from the 60s to the 90s, from revolutionary slogans to New Age psychobabble, from Franz Fanon to Robert Fulham, from the thrill of the underground to the banalities of the couch. But the banality does not stop there. This revolution has not just gone into therapy, it is heavily into food. When Bobby Seale, co-founder and chairman of the Black Panthers, finally produced his oeuvre, it was barbecuing with Bobby. Carlton Louis Armstrong, jailed for a 1970 University of Wisconsin bombing that injured 4 and killed 1, now runs a fruit juice business in Madison, Wisconsin. And Catherine Power, expert chef and cooking instructor, was renowned in her adopted Oregon for her recipes. Power's therapist, reports the New York Times, found it impossible to believe that this bespectacled cook with the terrific polenta recipe had spent 14 years as one of the Federal Bureau of Investigation's 10 most wanted fugitives. It starts with people power, it ends in polenta, a fitting finish to the radical 60s. But it is not quite right to close the book with this touch of cute domesticity. Let's remember who Catherine Power was and what she did. This was not a flower child caught up some wild afternoon in a robbery. She was found to have in her apartment 3 rifles, a carbine, a pistol, a shotgun, and a huge store of ammunition. She is accused of having firebombed a National Guard armory. She took part in a bank robbery in which a hero cop, father of 9, was shot dead. This is someone very hard who has now softened out of feelings of loss, principally for herself. After all these years, concludes Newsweek, it's hard to know whom to feel the most sympathy for, the Schroeder children who lost a father or the young woman who lost her way in the tumult of the 60s. That's a hard one. Reflecting on the man who learned to like himself in prison, Bloom notes that in the mind of this ex-con, the problem lay with his sense of self, not with any original sin or devils in him. We have here the peculiarly American way of digesting continental despair. It is nihilism with a happy ending, except for the orphans. Time, October 4th, 1993. Annals of Art. Culture Wars, Chapter 36. The Brooklyn Museum of Art readies an exhibition of high decadence called Sensation. The mayor of New York threatens to close down the museum if the exhibit is not canceled. The mayor is pilloried by the usual suspects, a consortium of New York museums, the ACLU, the highbrow press, for philistinism and/or First Amendment abuse. The exhibit itself is nothing very special, just the usual fantasy-echo celebration of the blasphemous, the criminal, and the decadent. The item that caught Rudy Giuliani's attention is a portrait of the Virgin Mary adorned with elephant dung and floating bits of female pornography. The one that caught my attention is the giant portrait of a child molester and murderer, made to look as if composed of tiny children's handprints. The Culture Guardian screams censorship. The mayor makes the quite obvious point that these artists can do anything the hell they want, but they have no entitlement to have the work exhibited in a museum subsidized by the taxpayers of New York City to the tune of $7 million a year. It is an old story. Art, whose very purpose is épater les bourgeois, is at the same time demanding the bourgeois' subsidy. Of course, if the avant-garde had any self-respect, it would shock the bourgeoisie on its own dime. But how silly. Self-respect is a hopelessly bourgeois value. The avant-garde lives by a code of fearless audacity and uncompromising authenticity, and endless financial support. The art world has sustained this cultural blackmail by counting on the status anxiety of the middle class. They are afraid to ask the emperor's new clothes question, why are we being forced to subsidize willful offensive banality, for fear of being considered terminally unsophisticated. This cultural blackmail has gone on for decades, with the artist loudly blaspheming everything his patrons hold dear, while suckling at their teats. Every once in a while, however, someone refuses to play the game. This time it is Giuliani, and sure enough, he's been charged with philistinism, or as the New York Times editorial put it, with making the city look ridiculous. The mayor's rationale, says the Times with unintended hilarity, derives from the fact that the city owns the Brooklyn Museum of Art and provides nearly a third of its operating budget. Rationale? It is self-evident. You own an institution, whether you're an individual, a corporation, or a city with duly elected authorities acting on its behalf. You regulate its activity. This is no rationale. It's a slam dunk, argument-ending QED clincher. Let's be plain. No one is preventing these artworks from being made or displayed. The only question is whether artists have a claim on the taxpayer's dollar in displaying it. The answer is open and shut. No. It is a question not of censorship, but of sensibility. Can there ever be a limit to the tolerance and generosity of the paying public? Of course. Does this particular exhibit forfeit whatever claim art has to public support and the legitimacy and honor conferred upon it by the stamp of the city-owned Brooklyn Museum? The Virgin Mary painting alone would merit an answer of yes. Add the child molester painting, the 3D acrylic women with erect penises for noses, space shit, and 1,000 years. Steel, glass, flies, maggots, MDF, insecticuter, cow's head, sugar water, 213 by 427 by 213 centimeters. And you get a fuller picture, an artistic sensibility that is a peculiar combination of the creepy and the banal. Of course, everyone loves to play victim. The status of victim being, as Anthony Daniels put it in the New Criterion, the personal equivalent of most favored nation. But the idea that art of this type is under assault or starved for funds is quite ridiculous. Art of this type is now the norm. It is everywhere. Galleries, museums, private collections are filled with it. It is classical representational art that is starved for funds. Try finding a school in your town that teaches classical drawing or painting. As James Cooper noted some years ago in the American Arts Quarterly, a modest grant to a small art academy was recently denied by the National Endowment for the Arts because, the terse NEA memo explained, teaching students to draw the human figure is revisionist and stifles creativity. Add some dung, though, and you've got yourself a show. The role of the artist has changed radically in the last century and a half. It was once the function of the artist to represent beauty and transcendence and possibly introduce it into the life of the beholder. With the advent of photography and film, the perfect media for both representation and narration, art has fought its dread of obsolescence by seeking some other role. Today, the function of the artist is to be an emissary to the aberrant, to live at the cultural and social extremes, to go over into the decadent and even criminal, to scout forbidden emotional and psychic territory, and bring back artifacts of that edgy experience to a bourgeoisie too cozy and cowardly to make the trip itself. This has been going on for decades. It must be said, however, that at the beginning of the transformation, there was an expectation that the artist would bring skill and a sense of craft to his work. Whether their conceit was dandyism, criminality, or sexual adventurism, free love, homosexuality, and the other once shocking taboos of yesterday, artists of the early modern period still felt a need to render their recreation of shock with style and technique. Having reached a time, however, when technique itself is considered revisionist, anti-creative, and of course bourgeois, all we are left with is the raw, stinking shock on display right now at the Brooklyn Museum of Art. It is important to note that the artists and promoters who provoked the great Brooklyn contretemps are not feigning their surprise at Giuliani's counterattack. They genuinely feel entitled to their subsidy. They genuinely feel they perform a unique and priceless service, introducing vicarious extremism into the utterly compromised lives of their bourgeois patrons. Ah, but every once in a while a burger arises and says to the artist, "No need to report back from the edge. You can stay where you are. We'll have our afternoon tea without acid, thank you." And then the fun begins. The Weekly Standard, October 11th, 1999. Natural Childbirth. Nancy Minor wanted to give birth to her baby at home. The fact that she was 39, that this was her first child, that there was no electricity in her rustic Middleburg cottage, did not daunt her. Assisting her were her husband, a friend, and a lay midwife. During the delivery, the baby's umbilical cord became compressed. The baby died. The midwife has now been charged with manslaughter. Lay midwifery is not certified and not legal in Virginia, but the midwife's lawyer said that she should not be held liable because she was simply doing what the parents wanted. I'm with the lawyer. If there was real justice in the world, it is the parents who would be in the dock, charged with criminal self-indulgence. This case is all about the rights of parents to make decisions about the welfare of their children, says Aaron Fulham, a Maryland nurse and member of the Maryland Friends of Midwives. Welfare of the children? If Nancy Minor had had the slightest concern about the welfare of her child, this at-risk 39-year-old prima gravida would have had her child in a hospital where, when the breech birth and compressed cord had been discovered, she could have had an emergency C-section and a good chance of saving her child. Should parents have the choice about the health care of their newborn, asked Fulham rhetorically? Of course. But the minor's choice, as the subsequent tragedy proved, was hardly about the newborn's health care. It was about the mother's karma. It was about the narcissistic pursuit of experience, the me generation's insistence on turning every life event, even those fraught with danger for others, into a personalized Hallmark moment. Minor protest in her own defense. Everyone was born at home a generation ago. Now they act like it's outrageous. More like 80 years ago, but no matter. Yes, 80 years ago, babies were born at home. And they died in droves. Almost 1 in 10 newborns died then. Fewer than 1 in 100 does now. Yes, childbirth used to be natural. But so are the accompanying death, disability, deformity, and disease. A parent's duty is to avoid these natural phenomena by all possible means. Today we have those means. They are called modern medicine. The whole natural childbirth phenomenon is an astonishing triumph of ideology over experience. Pain is normally, indeed naturally, something humans try to avoid, and the pain of childbirth is among life's most searing. It is also today entirely unnecessary. My older brother was born 50 years ago in Rio de Janeiro. Post-war Brazil not being a mecca of high-tech obstetrics, my mother delivered without anesthetics and suffered accordingly. 4 years later in New York, she had the opportunity to give birth differently. She quite sensibly chose to deliver, me, in a state of blissful unconsciousness. To this day, she has no doubt which was the more desirable experience. As for me, I must have entered the world as zonked as Janis Joplin left it, though with no apparent side effects. I don't even like beer. In the 60s and 70s, natural childbirth made a comeback, fueled by a peculiar combination of New Age mysticism and macho feminism. Today, thankfully, some feminist writers argue that hospital childbirth is all right, that it is not a betrayal of sisterhood, that there is no earthly reason to willfully embrace pain for the mother and danger for the child as a protest against the alleged patriarchal structure and technological tyranny of modern medicine. They could usefully use as text the case of Nancy Minor. I will no doubt be charged with lack of sympathy for a bereaved mother. I plead guilty. I reserve my sympathy instead for the lost child. Perhaps if we reserve for these wanton parents less sympathy and more scorn, less understanding and more opprobrium, we might deter some and save a few children. The Minors have every right to be Luddites, free spirits, foes of modern technology. But the original 18th-century industrial saboteurs sought to destroy the satanic textile mills by throwing their wooden shoes, sabots, into the machines. They didn't throw their children. The Washington Post, May 24th, 1996. The inner man? Who cares? As Bob Woodward likes to say, he is the gift that keeps on giving. Richard Nixon, that is. And an endless source of amusement he is. We have all been having a great chuckle listening to Nixon again. More tapes, more titillation. Most notably, his ranting and raving about Jews. Generally speaking, you can't trust the bastards, etc. As a Jew, I've been asked several times about these revelations. I am entirely unmoved. First, I wonder how anyone would fare who had an open microphone in his office for 3,700 hours running. Second, Nixon was suspicious and paranoid about everyone. So what else is new? Third and most important, I don't really care what a public figure thinks. I care about what he does. Let God probe his inner heart. Tell me about his outer acts. And what were Nixon's outer acts vis-a-vis Jews? Well, in 1973, he saved Israel from possible destruction with his massive weapons airlift during the Yom Kippur War. He even put the U.S. military on worldwide alert to keep the Russians from intervening on Egypt's behalf. I feel about Nixon the way I feel reading about Truman's occasional ethnic lapses. In private, Truman was a man who still could use a word like kike, writes David McCullough, or, in a letter to his wife, dismiss Miami as nothing but hotels, filling stations, Hebrews, and cabins. So what? Truman remains a hero to Jews for having recognized the State of Israel at the crucial moment of its birth in 1948. Herb Stein, who died last month, was chairman of Nixon's Council of Economic Advisers. Reflecting on Nixon's Jewish problem, he wrote that he never felt anything but the utmost respect and friendship from Nixon. Whatever Nixon's private thoughts, both in his personal relations and in his public actions as president, he was a friend of the Jews. It is part of the trivialization of politics that we give endless attention to the inner life of the politician, his private thoughts, his inner demons, at the expense of his outer life. I cannot, for example, imagine Pat Buchanan ever saying, even in private, anything as nasty about Jews as did Nixon. But the public Pat Buchanan goes around fanning hatred for Jews with his sly and not-so-sly allusions to Jewish power, Jewish influence, Jewish disloyalty. So who is the anti-Semite? Obsession with self is the motif of our time. It carries over into our thinking about public figures, to our preoccupation long predating our fascination with Gary Hart's nocturnal trysts, with their inner life. The reductio ad absurdum of this tendency is Edmund Morris's disastrous book on Reagan. The subject of the book is really not Reagan, but Morris. And when Morris does get around to Reagan, it is the inner Dutch that interests him, not the politician, the leader, the president. The results are comical. 7 pages spent on imagining Reagan's thoughts while making his first movie, 4 pages on the momentous years 1976 through 80, when Reagan remade American politics. Between Reagan's losing the nomination in 76 and winning the presidency in 80, the book is a near total blank. We hear about Morris's encounter with Jimmy Carter, Morris's publication of his Theodore Roosevelt biography, then get 1 page out of 674 on the 1980 campaign. One modern conceit is that the inner man is more important than the outer man. The second conceit is that somehow, thanks to Freud and modern psychobabble, we have real access to the inner man. As a former psychiatrist, I know how difficult it is to try to understand the soul of even someone you have spent hundreds of hours alone with in therapy. To think that one can decipher the inner life of some distant public figure is folly. Even the experts haven't a clue. Remember that group of psychiatrists, 1,189 strong, who in 1964 signed a statement asserting their professional judgment that Barry Goldwater was psychologically unfit to be president? The very attempt to make such a diagnosis at a distance is malpractice. Even Nixon, his private thoughts spilled out on tape forever, is no open book. Sure, the seething cauldron of incoherent hatreds and fears helps explain Watergate. But how do you match that with the man who cut through the paranoia and fear and opened the door to China, fashioned détente, and ushered in the era of arms control, something less psychically roiled presidents had not been able to do? Know thyself is a highly overrated piece of wisdom. As for knowing the self of others, forget it. Know what they do and judge them by their works. The Washington Post, October 15th, 1999. The mirror image fallacy. As is evident just from the look on his face, observes the New Yorker in a recent reflection on the Lincoln Memorial, Lincoln would have liked to live out a long life surrounded by old friends and good food. Good food? New Yorker readers have an interest in successful soufflés, but it's hard to recall the most melancholy and spiritual of presidents giving them much thought. New Yorker editors no doubt dream of living out their days grazing in gourmet pastures. But did Lincoln really long to retire to a table at Lutèce? Solipsism is the belief that the whole world is me, And as mathematician Martin Gardner points out, its authentic version is not to be found outside mental institutions. What is to be found outside the asylum is its philosophic cousin, the belief that the whole world is like me. This species of solipsism, plural solipsism, if you like, is far more common because it is far less lonely. Indeed, it yields a very congenial world, populated exclusively by creatures of one's own likeness, a world in which Lincoln pines for his dinner with Andre, or, more consequentially, where KGB chiefs and Iranian ayatollahs are, well, folks just like us. The mirror image fantasy is not as crazy as it seems. Fundamentally, it is a radical denial of the otherness of others, or to put it another way, a blinding belief in common humanity, in the triumph of human commonality over human differences. It is a creed rarely fully embraced. It has a disquieting affinity with martyrdom, but in a culture tired of such ancient distinctions as that between children and adults, in contemporary movies the kids are, if anything, wiser than their parents, or men and women, I was a better man as a woman with a woman than I've been as a man with a woman, says Tootsie, it can acquire considerable force. Its central axiom is that if one burrows deep enough beneath the Mao jacket, the shapka, or the chador, one discovers that people everywhere are essentially the same. 11-year-old American anthropologist Samantha Smith was invited to Moscow by Yuri Andropov for first-hand confirmation of just that proposition, a rare Soviet concession to the principle of on-site inspection. After a well-photographed sojourn during which she took in a children's festival at a young pioneer camp, but was spared the paramilitary training, she got the message. They're just, almost, just like us, she announced at her last Moscow press conference. Her mother, who is no longer 11 but makes up for it in open-mindedness, supplied the corollary. They're just like us. They prefer to work at their jobs than to work at war. That completes the syllogism. We all have eyes, hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions. We are all fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer. It follows, does it not, that we must all want the same things? According to Harvard cardiologist Bernard Laun, president of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, that's not just Shakespeare, it's a scientific fact that Russian and American hearts are indistinguishable, that both ache for peace and survival. Such breathtaking non sequiturs, cardiological or otherwise, are characteristic of plural solipsism. For it is more than just another happy vision. It is meant to have practical consequences. If people everywhere, from Savannah to Sevastopol, share the same hopes and dreams and fears and love of children and good food, they should get along. And if they don't, then there must be some misunderstanding, some misperception, some problem of communication. As one news report of the recent conference of Soviet and American peace activists in Minneapolis put it, the issue of human rights sparked a heated discussion and provided participants with a first-hand view of the obstacles to communication which so often characterize U.S.-Soviet relations. It is the broken telephone theory of international conflict, and it suggests a solution. Repair service by the expert facilitator, the Harvard negotiations professor. Hence the vogue for peace academies, the mania for mediators, the belief that the world's conundrums would yield to the right intermediary, the right presidential envoy, the right socialist international delegation. Yet Iraq's Saddam Hussein and Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini have perfectly adequate phone service. They need only an operator to make the connection. Their problem is that they have very little to say to each other. there are other consequences. If the whole world is like me, then certain conflicts become incomprehensible. The very notion of intractability becomes paradoxical. When the U.S. Embassy in Tehran is taken over, Americans are bewildered. What does the Ayatollah want? The U.S. government sends envoys to find out what token or signal or symbolic gesture might satisfy Iran. It is impossible to believe that the Ayatollah wants exactly what he says he wants, the head of the Shah. Things are not done that way anymore in the West. Even the Soviet bloc has now taken to pensioning off deposed leaders. It took a long time for Americans to get the message. Other messages from exotic cultures are never received at all. The more virulent pronouncements of third world countries are dismissed as mere rhetoric. The more alien the sentiment, the less seriously it is taken. Diplomatic fiascos follow, like Secretary Schultz's recent humiliation in Damascus. He persisted in going there despite the fact that President Assad had made it utterly plain that he rejected efforts by the U.S., the permanent enemy, to obtain withdrawal of Syrian forces from Lebanon. Or consider the chronic American frustration with Saudi Arabia. The Saudis consistently declare their refusal to accept the legitimacy of a Jewish state in the Middle East, a position so at variance with the Western view that it is simply discounted. The successive American governments continue to count on Saudi support for U.S. peace plans, only to be rudely let down. When the Saudis finally make it unmistakably clear that they will support neither Camp David, nor the Reagan plan, nor the Lebanon Accord, the U.S. reacts with consternation. It might have spared itself the surprise if it had not in the first place imagined that underneath those kafiyas are folks just like us, sharing our aims and views. The wise man shows his wisdom in separation, in gradation, and his scale of creatures and of merits is as wide as nature, writes Emerson. The foolish have no range in their scale, but suppose every man is as every other man. Ultimately, to say that people all share the same hopes and fears, are all born and love and suffer and die alike, is to say very little. For it is after commonalities are accounted for that politics becomes necessary. It is only when values, ideologies, cultures, and interests clash that politics even begins. At only the most trivial level can it be said that people want the same things. Take peace. The North Vietnamese want it, but apparently they wanted to conquer all of Indochina first. The Salvadoran right and left both want it, but only after making a desert of the other. The Reagan administration wants it, but not if it has to pay for it with pieces of Central America. And even if one admits universal ends, one still has said nothing about means, about what people will risk, will permit, will commit in order to banish their common fears and pursue their common hopes. One would think that after the experience of this century, the belief that a harmony must prevail between peoples who share a love of children and small dogs would be considered evidence of a most grotesque historical amnesia. From where does the idea of a world of likes come? In part from a belief in universal brotherhood, a belief that is parodied, however, when one pretends that the ideal already exists. In part from a trendy ecological pantheism, with its misty notions of the oneness of those sharing this lonely planet. In part from the Enlightenment belief in a universal human nature, a slippery modern creation that, for all its universality, manages in every age to take on a decidedly middle-class look. For the mirror image fantasy derives above all from the coziness of middle-class life. The more settled and ordered one's life, and in particular one's communal life, the easier it becomes for one's imagination to fail. In Scarsdale, destitution and desperation, cruelty and zeal are the stuff of headlines, not life. Thus, a single murder can create a sensation. In Beirut, it is a statistic. When the comfortable encounter the unimaginable, the result is not only emotional but cognitive rejection. Brutality and fanaticism beyond one's ken must be made to remain there. Thus, for example, when evidence mounts of biological warfare in faraway places, the most fanciful theories may be produced to banish the possibility. To gloss over contradictory interests, incompatible ideologies, and opposing cultures as sources of conflict is more than anti-political. It is dangerous. Those who have long held a mirror to the world and seen only themselves are apt to be shocked and panicked when the mirror is removed, as inevitably it must be. On the other hand, to accept the reality of otherness is not to be condemned to a war of all against all. We are not then compelled to see in others the focus of evil in the world. We are still enjoined to love our neighbors as ourselves, only it no longer becomes an exercise in narcissism. But empathy that is more than self-love does not come easily, particularly not to a culture so fixed on its own image that it can look at Lincoln, gaunt and grave, and see a man ready to join the queue at the pâté counter at Zabar's. Time, August 15, 1983. Chapter 5. Passions and Pastimes. The Joy of Losing. Among my various idiosyncrasies, the most baffling to my friends is my steadfast devotion to the Washington Nationals. When I wax lyrical about having discovered my own private paradise at Nationals Park, eyes begin to roll, and it is patiently explained to me that my Nats have been not just bad, but prodigiously, epically bad. As if I don't know. They lost 102 games in 2008, 103 in 2009. That's no easy feat. Only three other teams in the last quarter century have achieved back-to-back 100-loss seasons. Now understand, this is not the charming, cuddly, amusing incompetence of, say, the 62 Mets, of whom their own manager, Casey Stengel, famously asked, "Can't anybody here play this game?" and whose stone-gloved first baseman, Marv Thornberry, was nicknamed Marvelous Marv, the irony intended as a sign of affection. Nor am I talking about heroic, stoic, character-building losing. The Chicago Cubs fan knows that he's destined for a life of Sisyphean suffering and perpetual angst. Mr. Cub, Ernie Banks, may have said, "Let's play two," but in 19 years he never got to play even one postseason game. These guys go 58 years without winning, then come within five outs of the National League pennant, only to have one of their own fans deflect a ball about to settle into a Cub outfielder's glove, killing the play and bringing on the unraveling. The fan was driven into hiding, and the fateful ball ritually exorcised, blown to smithereens on TV. Sorry, that's not my kind of losing. Been there. I'm a former Red Sox fan, now fully rehabilitated. No, I don't go to games to steel my spine, perfect my character, journey into the dark night of the soul. I get that in my day job, watching the Obama administration in action. I go for relief, for the fun, for the craft, beautifully elucidated in George Will's just-reissued classic Men at Work, and for the sweet, easy cheer at Nationals Park. You get there, and the twilight's gleaming, the popcorn's popping, the kids are romping, and everyone's happy. The joy of losing consists in this. Where there are no expectations, there is no disappointment. In Tuesday night's game, our starting pitcher couldn't get out of the third inning. Gave up four straight hits, six earned runs, and as he came off the mound, actually got a few scattered rounds of applause. Applause! In New York, he'd have been booed mercilessly. In Philly, he'd have found his car on blocks and missing a headlight. No one's happy to lose, and the fans cheer lustily when the Nats win. But as starters blow up and base runners get picked off, there is none of the agitation, the angry screaming, beer spilling, red-faced ranting you get at football or basketball games. Baseball is a slow, boring, complex, cerebral game that doesn't lend itself to histrionics. You take in a baseball game, something odd to say about a football or basketball game, with the clock running and the bodies flying. And for a losing baseball team, the calm is even more profound. I've never been to a park where the people are more relaxed, tolerant, and appreciative of any small, even moral victory. Sure, you root for the home team. But if they don't win, it's a shame, not a calamity. Can you imagine arm-length fans swaying to such a sweetly corny song of early 20th century innocence, as hard to find today as a manual typewriter or a 20-game winner, at the 2-minute warning? But now I fear for my bliss. Hope of a sort is on its way in the form of Steven Strasburg, the greatest pitching prospect in living memory. His fastball clocks 103 miles an hour, and his slider, says Tom Boswell, breaks so sharply it looks like it hit a bird in midair. In spring training, center fielder Niger Morgan nicknamed him Jesus. Because of the kid's presence, persona, charisma? Nope. Because that's what everybody says the first time they see Strasburg throw, explained Morgan. Jesus. But now I'm worried. Even before Strasburg has arrived from the minor leagues, the Nats are actually doing well. They're playing 500 ball for the first time in 5 years. They are hovering somewhere between competent mediocrity and respectability. When Jesus arrives, my guess is late May, they might actually be good. They might soon be, gasp, a contender, in the race deep into September. Good enough to give you hope and break your heart. Where does one then go for respite? The Washington Post, April 23rd, 2010. Beauty, Truth, and Hitchcock. While the rest of the sporting world was distracted with sideshows, the World Series, the Douglas Holyfield fight, the main event was being played out in utter silence at the Hudson Theater on Broadway, where the two best players in the world, Garry Kasparov and Anatoly Karpov, were fighting it out for the championship of chess. After 12 games, the match is tied. Now, mention chess, and most people's eyes glaze over. They think of two old geezers, one of whom has died but no one has noticed, in overstuffed armchairs at the Diogenes Club. Know how chess crowds do the wave, guffawed a CBS newsreader? With their eyebrows. Ho, ho. What the benighted don't understand is that modern chess is played not just against an opponent, but against the clock. It thus produces a heart-stopping equivalent of football's 2-minute drill. At move 32 of game 8, for example, challenger Karpov, losing, was forced to make 9 moves in less than 3 minutes. He executed them in a dazzling flurry that didn't just leave him winning. It left the crowd stunned and silent, except, that is, for one patron who, unnerved by Karpov's preposterous escape, let out a loud, shocking laugh. Moreover, the place to watch World Championship chess is not in the theater, but 5 floors up, in the analysis room. There the action is frenzied. One TV monitor shows the players and the running time clocks. The other shows the latest board position. Scattered about are a score of the greatest players in the world, a couple of whom are standing at the front, trying dozens of follow-on combinations on a large demonstration board. The result is a tumult of lightning analysis, inspired second-guessing, withering criticism, contemptuous asides, suggestions and refutations as the pros search for the best possible lines into the future. During Game 8, I found myself in the room with the U.S. chess champion, Lev Albert, four grandmasters, and one legend, former world champion Mikhail Tal. It was like watching the World Series with five Hall of Famers parsing every pitch and Cy Young correcting them. On Karpov's 23rd move, the parsing got slightly crazy. If Kasparov does A, then Karpov must do B. If Kasparov then tries C, and Karpov answers with D, look out. E, F, and G follow. But if Kasparov does Z, then... Some of these lines were harmony, variations on the main theme of the game. Some were jazz riffs, freestyle and whimsical. Some were just fanciful trills, exotic and occasionally atonal. They all went up on the board fast and furious, as potsers, plodding amateurs like me, struggled to follow the logic. Then Karpov did something unexpected. He advanced a pawn, unbalancing the position and not a few grandmasters. Instantly, all heretofore examined lines, entire symphonies of hypothetical variation, vanished into the ether. Unheard melodies, murmured the yellow-tied potser sitting next to me. His tone was wry and regretful. The move done, the grandmasters wiped the slate clean and began composing fresh music, speculating on what might follow next. This greatly disturbed the dapper young Yugoslav grandmaster Ljubomir Lubojevich. Shaking his head in disapproval, Lubo strode up to the board, took down all the moves now being essayed, and brought the position back not to move 23, but to move 22. If Karpov had pushed the pawn on move 22, instead of first delivering that ridiculous check, the now animated Lubo insisted, it would have been a triumph. He then gave a long demonstration of the truth of his analysis. Of course, by then it was irrelevant. Karpov had played the check first. Enough of history, said the others, impatient to get on with analyzing the world as it now existed. Lubo insisted on analyzing the world as it should exist. As the groans grew louder, Lubo's retort was indignant. Let's find some truth here. The yellow-tied potser had come for beauty, but Lubo had come for truth. In chess, that means finding not just a good move, or even a harmonious move, but the perfect move, God's move. Playing chess with divinity can be dangerous, however. The great Steinitz, who once claimed to have played against God and won, he neglected to leave a record of the game, went quite mad. The last great practitioner of truth, Bobby Fischer, after winning the world championship in 1972, disappeared into some apocalyptic sect in California and had the fillings in his teeth removed to stop the KGB transmissions. Melodies you can get in any record store, but truth? Where else can you find truth? The next day I saw Lubo again. It was 12 hours later, and he was still shaking his head. Down on the Hudson stage, however, the protagonists were engaged not so much in truth-seeking as in attempted murder. Kasparov, who calls Karpov a creature of darkness, had declared his intent not just to defeat Karpov, but to destroy him. Accordingly, Kasparov played the opening games with the confident, reckless belligerence of a young Ali. Karpov, though, was fully Frazier's equal. The result was mayhem, rarely seen at that level of play. It was like a title fight with 10 knockdowns by round 3, or, for the more delicate, like a ballet performed not on a stage, but on a trampoline. Even the exalted were amazed by the innovations, the sacrifices, the speculative attacks, the kind of stuff a potser like me tries out in Washington's Lafayette Square, not the kind world champions play with $1.7 million at stake. I asked the great and wizened Tal what he thought of the opening games of the match. Hitchcock movies, he replied with a grin. Beauty, truth, and Hitchcock. Now that's entertainment. Time, November 19th, 1990. Fermat solved. Fermat's last theorem is solved, and a generation of tormented German graduate students can now go fishing. Imagine you have some interest in biblical archaeology and see advertised a lecture on, say, calibrated radiocarbon chronology of royal Judean storage jars, or some such. You go to the lecture, at the end of which the speaker says, "And oh, by the way, on Thursday I found the Holy Grail in the basement of a bed and breakfast in downtown Jericho. Here it is." Well, something comparable happened in Cambridge, England, last week. A group of mathematicians attended a conference on, hold on, Piedic Galois representations, Iwasawa theory, and the Tamagawa numbers of motives. They went, as audiences do, expecting entertainment and instruction. What they got was astonishment. They went to hear Professor Andrew Wiles deliver three lectures on modular forms, elliptic curves, and Galois representations. At the end of the third lecture, Wiles noted that his presentation had just proved Fermat's last theorem, the most famous and elusive mathematical puzzle of the last 300 years. If Wiles' claim holds up, and its 200 pages of reasoning are so difficult that only a handful of mathematicians are in a position to judge, he will be hailed for his mathematical genius. He should be equally hailed for his modesty. Dropping his bombshell at the end of a lecture, without a hint of the now usual cold fusion-type advanced publicity, is in itself an achievement in this age of hype. In science, modesty and genius do not coexist well together. In Washington, modesty and cleverness don't. Einstein is perhaps the most famous exception to the rule, yet even Watson and Crick, discoverers of the genetic code and not known for their modesty, proved themselves capable of one admirable, indeed immortal, act of understatement. Toward the end of their epic two-page paper revealing the structure of DNA, they noted dryly, "It has not escaped our notice that the specific pairing, that is, zipper-like structure of DNA, we have postulated, immediately suggests a possible copying mechanism for the replication of the genetic material." For hundreds of years, humans had known that hereditary traits are transmitted from parent to child, but they hadn't a clue as to how. Watson and Crick had just provided the clue. Wiles, however, is due homage not just for his genius and his modesty, but for his courage. Courage is not a quality one normally associates with mathematicians, yet it should apply to people who work in their attics, in secret, for 7 years without cease, on a problem that has eluded the greatest mathematical minds since first proposed in 1637. I once had a friend in Oxford who drifted into the study of Hegel, that famously impenetrable German philosopher, and was never seen again. There are intellectual black holes, vortexes of endless regression, that mortals ought to stay clear of. Many mathematicians have felt that way about Fermat's last theorem. Its allure lies not just in its longevity, but in its simplicity. It can be written on one line, x to the n plus y to the n equals z to the n is impossible when n is greater than 2. Meaning that while a square can be broken into two smaller squares, 25, the square of 5, can be broken into 16, the square of 4, plus 9, the square of 3, one cannot divide a cube into two smaller cubes, and for that matter, one cannot divide any higher power into two smaller numbers of the same power. It is a proposition so vexing and mathematically profound that the French Academy of Science has offered a gold medal and 300 francs for its solution. That was in 1815, the year Napoleon was just settling into his new digs on St. Helena. It is a proposition so famous that perhaps the one person on earth most grateful for the Wiles solution, after the professor's wife and daughters, "Daddy's back, is Dr. Martin Kneser of the Göttingen Academy of Sciences. He administers another Fermat Prize, the Wolfshekel Prize, first offered in 1908, now 7,500 marks, which means that poor Dr. Kneser must fight his way through 3 meters of correspondence from every crank on the planet who is sure he has bested Fermat. How does he handle the mountain of mail? In recent decades, wrote Kneser's predecessor, it was handled in the following way. The Secretary of the Academy divides the arriving manuscripts into 1, complete nonsense, which is sent back immediately, and into 2, material which looks like mathematics. The second category is given to young research assistants, forced by poverty and induced by payment, to search for the inevitable mistakes. One would-be Fermat slayer sent half a solution and demanded 1,000 marks before he would produce the other half. Another also demanded money up front, promising 10% of the radio and TV take that would follow his fame and threatening, if denied, to send his solution to Russia. Consider then what Wiles has wrought. A generation of tormented German graduate students can now go fishing. Kneser is free at last. Fermat is vindicated, and the rest of us are treated to a rare, irrefutable demonstration that the hairless ape with the opposable thumb is indeed now and then capable of something that deserves the name progress. The Washington Post, July 2, 1993. Be afraid. As was to be expected, the end of civilization as we know it was announced on the back pages. On February 10, 1996, in Philadelphia, while America was distracted by the rise of Pat Buchanan, the fall of Phil Gramm, and other trifles, something large happened. German philosophers call such large events world historical. This was larger. It was species-defining. The New York Times carried it on page A32. On February 10th, Garry Kasparov, the best chess player in the world, and quite possibly the best chess player who ever lived, sat down across a chessboard from a machine, an IBM computer called Deep Blue, and lost. True, it was only one game. What kind of achievement is that? Well, as Henny Youngman used to say when asked, "How's your wife?" Compared to what? Compared to human challenges for the world championship? Just 5 months ago, the same Kasparov played a championship match against the next best player of the human species. The number 2 human played Kasparov 18 games and won 1. Deep Blue played Kasparov and won its very first game. And it was no fluke. Over the first 4 games, the machine played Kasparov dead even. 1 win, 1 loss, 2 draws, before the champ rallied and came away with the final 2 games. Kasparov won the match. That was expected. Game 1, however, was not supposed to happen. True, Kasparov had lost to machines in speed games and other lesser tests, and lesser grandmasters have lost regulation games to machines. But never before in a real game played under championship conditions had a machine beaten the best living human. Indeed, Kasparov, who a few weeks ago single-handedly took on the entire national chess team of Brazil, was so confident of winning that he rejected an offer that the $500,000 purse be split 60-40 between winner and loser. Kasparov insisted on winner-take-all. They settled on 80-20. What, by the way, does Deep Blue do with its 100-grand purse? New chips? Asked when he thought a computer would beat the best human, Kasparov had said 2010 or maybe never. A mutual friend tells me Garry would have gladly offered 1-10, perhaps even 1-100 odds on himself. That was all before game 1. After game 1, Kasparov was not offering any odds at all. He was devastated, said his computer coach, Frederick Friedel. It was a shattering experience. We didn't know what the game meant. There was a theoretical possibility that the computer would be invincible and that he would lose all six games. True, we've already created machines that can run faster, lift better, see farther than we can. But cars, cranes, and telescopes shame only our limbs and our senses, not our essence. Thinking is our specialty, or so we think. How could a device capable of nothing more than calculation of the possible moves and scoring of the relative strengths of the resulting positions possibly beat a human with a lifetime of experience, instant pattern recognition, unfathomable intuition, and a killer instinct? How, with sheer brute force, calculation and evaluation at cosmic speeds? At the height of the game, Deep Blue was seeing about 200 million positions every second. You and I can see one, Kasparov two, maybe three. But 200 million, it was style versus power, and power won. It was like watching Muhammad Ali floating and stinging try to box a steamroller in a very small ring. The results aren't pretty. What is Deep Blue's secret? Grandmaster Yasser Seirawan put it most succinctly. The machine has no fear. He did not just mean the obvious, that silicon cannot quake. He meant something deeper. Because of its fantastic capacity to see all possible combinations some distance into the future, the machine, once it determines that its own position is safe, can take the kind of attacking chances no human would. The omniscient have no fear.